thank the organizers for putting this together. They've done a very good job. And I thank you all for coming despite this being optional. So I'd like to tell you about my research, which has to do with investigating how the renormalization group plays a key role as the mechanism behind the emergence of a direction of space in the context of the holographic duality. I'll get to all that, but the idea was that this has to be a description of our research in broad strokes. And to be very broad, let's ask a lofty question of how to organize knowledge. And here's one way, where you have fields according to purity, and you have the mathematicians on one side, sociologists on the other, each one telling each other, oh, this is applied that. And this annoyed a biologist who writes a blog, and he drew this, where you organize it by real and imaginary. And you see theoretical physicists are kind of hanging off on one side, barely real. And there's still the social scientists always lose in this for some reason. But these two pictures miss a certain point, which is why no one's volunteering to do each other's job, why everyone gets to be called, you know, physicist versus mathematician versus sociologist or psychologist. And that's because our universe is full of emergent phenomena. And that the collective behavior of many constituents is very different from the behavior of any individual one. So picture that emphasizes this best, I thought, was this one, which is a rough sketch of our cosmic history. Now, if you were over there, you went in Barak's time machine all the way to the left of this, then you could only be a particle physicist, really. I mean, those were the only phenomena that were out there. There were no atoms, there were no molecules, there was no chemistry. And if you wanted to be a nuclear physicist, you'd have to be somewhere over here, at least. And then if you wanted to be a chemist, maybe here. And then, you know, the biologists and sociologists all come in way deeper over there. And why I like this image is because it points out that despite the fact that there are such things as emergent phenomena, and that the physics at larger scales is different from that at smaller ones, or just the description of systems at a larger scale are different from the smaller ones, it does matter to some extent what things are made of, right? I mean, despite the fact that you don't need to know quantum mechanics to understand particle trajectories with Newtonian mechanics the way you do in school, it still helps that what you're modeling is a solid, which follows a certain trajectory. And the fact that it's a solid is, you know, it has to do with forces between molecules and atoms. So it's not to say that everything about the short distance physics is irrelevant. So what we would like to do, if there were a science of emergence, which we're far from, is to be able to characterize what aspects of phenomena at a certain scale affect those at another. And now, of course, in all generality, we don't know how to do this. I mean, we don't know how to get from even chemistry to biology in a very good way. The question of from whence life emerged also sits in this wider set of questions. So I think that we should be a little bit more modest and ask if there is any set of phenomena where we do have a good understanding of emergence in a more precise way. And okay, so as I was saying before, I spoke about Newtonian mechanics and solids, but it helps to know what's made of what for specific questions you want to ask. Like, if you want to know why a certain liquid is more viscous than another, you need to know something about the forces between the molecules that constitute the liquid. And of course, the magic of magnets is, comes straight out of the exchange interaction between their molecules. But in the theory of critical phenomena, or phase transitions, as they're called in physics, we do have a prototype of way to characterize emergence, as in when does physics at a shorter scale become relevant to physics at a longer scale? What about it is irrelevant? And these are technical terms, as I'll explain later. But despite them being a narrow set of phenomena, they're not that narrow, because they describe many things, such as the phase transitions that we're used to between the states of matter, you know, liquids, gas, solids, and fluids. Or they could also describe something as fancy as high temperature superconductivity. Although my attention will be restricted to the kinds of phase transitions that the left-hand picture describes, which are classical, whereas this gets into the realm of quantum critical phenomena, which to some extent Jing touched upon yesterday when he was talking about deconfined quantum critical points and such. Okay, so moving on from here. I don't want to do the job if you're StatMech lecture for them, but there's a few preliminaries that we might need. So what statistical mechanics does for us is tell us how to relate microstates of the system to macrostates. So you have a microscopic Hamiltonian action, which describes the interactions between constituents of your system. And you want to understand how to extrapolate from that to large-scale thermodynamic quantities, which are related to this gadget called the partition function. So it's really almost a free energy, as you'll learn soon. And the Hamiltonian or Euclidean action really specifies what theory we're dealing with of these constituents. So I'm trying to be very general here. So it's just a sum of terms of this kind. You call J's sources and O's operators. And no matter what action you have, you can always write it this way. And I've been very general here because I let these sources depend on space. But your first exposure to them will be in the guise of coupling constants, which are just constant sources. These operators are monomials in fields and their derivatives. And you compute what are called correlation functions, connected correlation functions, which are what you go measure in a lab if you're ever given a system. Now, I keep talking about fields, but what are they? So where are continuous fields in systems like this, you know, like a magnet or fluid? To get some intuition for that, let's take a spin system, right? Like, as I said, how you build up a magnet is you think of very many spins dancing together. And so this is a model of a ferromagnet, where each of these spins is, say, one of the molecules. And the top two pictures are two ground states of the system. And the excitations all take this form. They're these long wavelength spin waves. And you know they're related to what people call magnons if you quantize them. So it's a quasi-particle in the parlance of condensed matter physics. But the point here is that you use the fluctuations in the mean spin, or you know, which you relate to the magnetization, as your field for this system, and then it can have this seemingly continuous description, which again I'll explain soon, because you know, as this stands, it looks very discrete. But before going any further, I'd like to answer the question of what happens when we change the scale at which we ask our questions, right? What happens if we probe the system at higher energies, or usually you go from higher to shorter, higher to smaller energies, or from shorter to larger length scales. But what happens is that interactions between whatever the excitations of these fields are start to screen or anti-screen. So you learn that these statistical field theories are cousins of the quantum field theories which we use to build the standard model. You know, so quantum electrodynamics, quantum thermodynamics. You change time-like direction of space-time to a space-like one. You can interpret it as a Euclidean field theory. Again, this is a spoiler for what happens in quantum field theory too. But the point is that the screening of interactions is very much the same phenomenon as the one which describes these phase transitions and so on, as in this thing I called the renormalization group to begin with. So the idea is, what happens to, say, this process of photons scattering with electrons as I up the energy, right? I mean, as I go to higher energies, I mean, can I still use the same coupling constant? Well, the answer is no. And the coupling constant gets stronger because quantum effects give rise to this kind of screening of the interaction. But that doesn't necessarily have to happen. So in the theory of the strong force, as you go to higher energies, there's really something called anti-screening happening. So as you get closer to the quark, you start to see that it gets ever more free. This picture is a little bit deceptive because I haven't drawn the gluons, which do most of the work of the anti-screening. And you need just the right number of gluons versus quarks in order to have this phenomenon called asymptotic freedom, where the force gets weaker as you go to higher energies. But as I said, in the end, what we'd like to do is understand how these sources run with energies, run with the energy scale, which I've denoted as mu. Now, in systems with relativistic invariance, you can trade the energy scale for a length scale. And so you could think of that in either of these complementary ways. And you compute these things called the beta functions, which are these derivatives. And should you be able to compute all of them exactly, then you've more or less solved the theory. You've more or less understood everything that could happen under probing the theory with, you know, at different length scales or energy scales. You almost never can do this. I mean, life is never that kind to us. And the principle behind obtaining equations for these beta functions, let me just use the pointer, is that physical correlation functions don't run with the energy scale. And if you recall, you obtain all physical correlation functions from this gadget called a partition function. So that should roughly tell you how you get these equations. Okay, so now let's get to the punchline, which is what I promised earlier, that there is, in the theory of phase transitions and critical phenomena, a way to characterize how short distance physics influences long distance physics. And that is through this criterion of relevance, irrelevance, or marginality, which applies to operators. So near any fixed point of this renormalization group, basically near a point where these beta functions vanish, you can linearize these equations, and you find that the beta function always takes this form. So the leading order term has this difference between the dimensions of space in which this theory lives and what are called the scaling dimensions of the operator to which J couples. And you see, if this sign, I mean, if this term is positive, then this grows as you run your RG flow. That means that this operator corresponding to delta I is relevant to long distance physics. And then vice versa, if this decreases under the RG flow, it's irrelevant. Now there's the borderline case where this just vanishes, and then you call such an operator marginal. And what that indicates is that there isn't quite a fixed point, but really there could be a whole surface of fixed points. But I put an asterisk here because that only happens under very special circumstances. And you can talk to me later to understand why that is. I mean, most often what happens is that when you go beyond the linearized approximation, you see that these couplings are either marginal, I mean, are either relevant or irrelevant. Okay. So at the end of the day, you have a picture that looks like this in the space of theories. Why I call this the space of theories is because per source, I have an operator, right? Go back here. So per source, I have an operator. So if you told me what the source is, I'll tell you what the operator is to which it couples. And so any point here, right, on this infinite dimensional space of sources, specifies for me a theory, right? It specifies an action. I just take all the sources, multiply them by operators, add everything together, and that's an action. So that's why you call this theory space. And as I said, generically, it's infinite dimensional. And then there are these special fixed points, right, where the beta functions vanish, where you're not going anywhere if you probe the system with probes of higher energy, or you know, you zoom out and rescale in length. But if you tune parameters to slightly get away from there, then you have the IRG flows taking you either to other fixed points. Sometimes you can go nowhere. And you notice that the direction of these arrows kind of matters, because here you can flow in from CFD UV CFD1 to this CFD2, and you can, by adding the right deformations, flow out to these two theories, whereas you're only flowing out of this theory. And you associate to these fixed points that are, you call them completely unstable, ultraviolet physics, because this is where you start to go to description in terms of lower energy variables, lower energy degrees of freedom. Whereas here, you could think of this as quantum field theory describing infrared physics, because you know there is an RG flow from somewhere to here. So, yeah.
Sorry, could you just explain what the RG flow is?
Oh, it's the flow of couplings under the change of energy scale. I'll give you another picture in space as to what this is or what it might look like, right? Because I've been a little bit, the discussion is still a little bit abstract about what this energy scale means, right? And as I said, it could be traded for a length scale in a lot of situations. And that is going to matter eventually. So despite the fact that we have these, at least mathematical criteria, the normalization group, right, even the words are very misleading, because it's not one thing. It's a set of different methods and techniques. It doesn't always have to do with renormalization in the sense that there's not always infinities that you're removing or anything being normalized at all. And it's not a group, because there are no inverses. So there's this ambiguity which the field kind of suffers from. But yeah, in terms of theory space, is just how you get from one theory to another, right? Your only move is I change the scale at which I'm probing the theory, right? Either the energy scale or the length scale. So I'm zooming out, or I'm, you know, using probes of lesser energy. So what happens at fixed points, though, is that it doesn't matter, well, it shouldn't matter how much you zoom out, and nothing should change. In fact, you could even zoom in and nothing should change. So there has to be the emergence of a symmetry called scale invariance, as in invariance under relabeling all lengths, expanding all lengths, contracting them. And you get these fractal-looking pictures for systems like the Ising model, for example. And it's not really easy to see here, but you can actually shrink this, fit it somewhere over here, shrink this, fit it somewhere over here, shrink this, and fit it somewhere over here. So if you go to this website, there's a little video that shows you how to do that. So that means that if I were to double all length scales here, then I can actually fit that somewhere over here, and you know, so on and so forth. So there's this kind of fractal structure emerging at fixed points. And this is one example that is a magnet near the Curie point. So the Curie point is a temperature to which you heat a magnet so that it loses its magic. So you know, heat it past that point, doesn't matter how much I rub it with another magnet, it's not going to stick to the refrigerator. But you could draw a similar picture for, you know, the vaporization of liquid carbon dioxide, or even the second order phase transition of, you know, water to steam. And you always find this symmetry emerging. So this is what ties the study of scale invariant field theories or conformal field theories to statistical physics. Okay, so as Sabine was asking, what is the renormalization group? What are these transformations? Well, concretely, in spin systems, so Kadanoff figured out a nice way to do this. So you start with a spin system, so a lattice of spins, and then you block this lattice. So you draw these 9x9 boxes or blocks, and then according to majority rule, or flip a coin, if you've chosen an even number, to decide what the overall average spin is in each of these blocks. And that's what these gray arrows indicate. And then you rescale everything to go back to this smaller size. So, start with this, block this, get here, go back, that fits in here, and you keep doing this. And this is how you technically zoom out. So, concretely, the size, the lattice spacing for these block spins is rescaled compared to that of the original system. Yeah.
I have a stupid question, but what would happen if you have an even number of spins and it cancels?
You could do something like just toss a coin. Like if you were implementing this as So there are other, in concrete numerical implementations, it's not always just something like majority rule. So there are other ways. So a good question, though. So this is a good picture to keep in mind, because there's a lot that works in analogy to these coarse grating transformations. So now let me try to move towards the second part of my talk, which is what all this has to do with holography. And so before I go into what holography is, which is a mapping between statistical field theories in some number of dimensions and gravitational ones in one higher dimension, I'd like to share an anecdote, which is back when I was a sci student, like you guys, I had a friend whom I used to discuss various problems with, and he once repudiated me by saying, your problem is you just relate every single problem to something to do with general relativity. Like this, works a lot for you, but it's kind of annoying. And then I decided to take this as a badge of honor and see, what can I understand from doing this a lot, like this using this move of relating things to general relativity. And I found that there was these people who were relating quantum field theories and renormalization to general relativity. So let's start by stacking these snapshots, right, of this block spin transformation on top of each other, right? Just so that you get the mirage that the renormalization group kind of generates this radial evolution in this one higher dimensional space, right? So I think of these as instance of time, but now it's not time-like, so it's instance of radius or space. And then, you don't have to do it quite so discreetly anymore, right? So, you could even do this with curved background, right? You could have metric being one of the sources in your theory. And you can rescale that, right, by multiplying it everywhere, at every point, by a positive function. This is really the continuum analog of this block spin transformation I was talking about before. So now I could have a theory describing a sequence of metrics, right? And the real question is, how is a sequence of metrics going to become, metrics on spaces going to become theory of a metric on space-time, right? So this is the next part of the talk, but this is precisely what happens in what's called a holographic duality. So you have on the boundary of some space, quantum field theory, and there's this bulk, which you basically construct by stacking RG snapshots on top of each other, but now in the continuum. And the description of physics in this box is given by general relativity coupled to some matter fields under the right circumstances. And the question is how? So what makes the theory holographic? Like, how is it that these people are doing my trick so much better than I am? So in terms of equations, there's a dictionary that relates every operator or a subset of operators of the theory on the boundary to fields in the bulk. And similarly, you can do that with the metric. But note that this is the metric on a slice of constant radius or time or whatever you want to call it, right? So it's not quite the space-time metric. And so, as I said, the bulk dynamics is the renormalization group flow. And these scaling dimensions are roughly related to masses. So that gives you an idea of how, like, what mass is to just dynamics, the scaling dimension is to RG. So this, it makes it kind of precise. Okay, so let's go back to the question I was asking. So what makes a theory holographic, right? Say I was given a sequence of spaces, right, with some metric on each of them, right? There's a one-parameter family of these. When can I stack them all together and pretend like they're all slices of a one higher dimensional space-time? Now, these are not the same thing, because this picture, this flag, has an enhanced symmetry in comparison to this funny picture, because I could slice this some other way, right? And it would still be the same flag. So this has to somehow be encoded in the renormalization group of the quantum field theory living on one of these slices. So, okay, proceed. I mean, are there any questions as to what the question is? No? Okay.
Wait.
Yeah, sure.
So that last thing that you said is, how does diffeomorphism invariance,
exactly,
that size on the higher thing theory, is manifested?
Precisely. So, as Juan mentioned, the invariance under cutting this picture up in a different pattern is related to a gauge invariance of the theory of general relativity called diffeomorphism invariance. And the question is, how does this emerge in holography? Right? This is what you really need to say that there's a direction of space-time emerging from the renormalization group. Because space-time is special. In that it possesses, I mean, it's a geometry. It doesn't care about any set of coordinates you use to slice it up or measure lengths on it. So. And in general relativity, what you can do is ask, how do I evolve hypersurfaces of, say, constant time, call it time, call it radius, whatever you want, into each other? And it turns out that you do it through these constraint functions, right? Which you'll, well, eventually realize that they're just components of the Einstein equations, but they're what generate the deformations of hypersurfaces normal and orthogonal to each other. It's nice that they happen to be the Einstein equations, because if you could get them to come out of just this requirement that the invariance emerges, you get the Einstein equations to emerge. So, let me put that a little bit more precisely. So I want to find how I go from this hypersurface to this one. And if I'm free to slice up space-time any way I like, I could go in two different ways, right? I could, you know, choose one foliation where I hop here and then hop there. Or I could go the other way, like vice versa. I use this one first, this one second. This computes for me a commutator between these two functions. And the net result should be one of these tangential deformations, right? This is what I technically mean when I say that I should be able to cut this picture up in different ways, right? That I should be able to slice this up in multiple ways. Now, it turns out that on the phase space of general relativity, there's a unique answer to the question of what functions manifest this weird commutator property. And they happen to be these components of the Einstein tensor. In other words, the Einstein equations are the only thing that'll let you hop from one hypersurface to another in a way that doesn't care about how you cut space-time up into leaves of, you know, constant radius. So basically, what you want the renormalization group to do is encode this funny pattern of, you know, diffeomorphism transformations or hopping transformations between sort of one slice and the next, right? So you can ask, what does it mean to have a peculiar kind of renormalization group transformation? And this goes back to the ambiguity that I was telling you about. before, which is that there isn't just one way to identify scale unambiguously in a problem, right? I mean, if we just think about it, we just name two, right? And, you know, in principle, there could be infinitely many of them. We want to identify scale and move it around so that we get exactly this pattern of transformations that the field theory manifests, right? So that all goes into what's irrelevant about the theory. So here's a picture. Again, let's go back to just conventional statistical mechanics. So this is these are molecules of, say, a gas in a box, or a fluid in a box. And I'm interested in understanding phase transition in this fluid, a second order phase transition in this fluid. And allow me to do a sequence of very brutal approximations, right? First, I model these by giving a sort of repulsive potential between these molecules, and then them also having this sort of hardcore repulsive term in their interaction. Then let me restrict all molecules to sit on sites of a lattice. Then let me put in a spin variable for that points up when there is a molecule and points down when there's a vacancy. Then I find myself at the Ising model. This sounds preposterous. Like, why would I be allowed to do any of this? But it turns out that if I'm only interested in understanding the behavior of these two systems near the critical point, right, near phase transition, any details about these being molecules of a gas and these being the spins in a magnet are completely irrelevant, right? So that's what irrelevant operators do for you. The ones that we said don't affect long-distance physics. So the difference between any odd way of doing my block spin transformations and the right way to do them so that this symmetry is manifest has to do with finding certain irrelevant operators by which, you know, I implement scale. So before I go any further, let me try and describe how in continuum quantum field theory you implement these block spin-like transformations. And for that, I need to introduce, some technology from Wilson and Polchinski. But just scalar field theory, right, described by, say, this kinetic term and some interactions, is divergent. And you will hear about this during your quantum field theory course. But what I could do to alleviate these divergences is introduce this higher derivative regulator, where lambda has dimensions of length. And basically, that corresponds to adding these very awful looking higher derivative operators to the action. Again, they're all increasingly irrelevant, but they do help with making calculations finite. So the point is that despite the fact that they are irrelevant, keeping them around helps you actually do something concretely. And that's why we tolerate these at all. But more importantly, this scale is really the analog of the lattice spacing here. And if you recall, we were performing normalization group transformations by rescaling the lattice spacing. And now we can do the same by pulling down this cutoff. So let's go back to this partition function. And to make everything concrete, we implement the regularization I just mentioned before. What you can do is perform the path integral in steps organized according to energies. And this was Wilson's insight. So if you integrate out a thin shell of fields with momenta between lambda and lambda minus delta, then you introduce set of additional interactions into your action, gives you what's called the effective action. But now that effective action lives at a lower scale. And Polchinski said, well, we could turn this into a differential equation that we solve for the interaction part of the action. So what I mean by that is the integral over this part of the Lagrangian. This is called Polchinski's equation, and convince yourselves that this, in principle, allows you to compute beta functions. I mean, in principle, but the only point I wish to make here is that irrelevant operators allow you to introduce a knob into your system that you can tune, call scale, and rescale by. And that's what we want to do even in these holographic theories. So we want to find which operators allow us to or give us a scale that we can tune so that in the bulk we're moving from one constant radius hypersurface to the next in a variant way, and we obtain Einstein's equations and all this wonderful stuff. And it turns out that there's just a finite number of them, which is very peculiar, because here, as you can see, there's an infinite number of these terms that we need in order to actually implement the regularization. And as I said before, under the renormalization group flow, these operators are driven to zero. So the picture we have is that we can do holography at a finite radius by adding to the action on the boundary these irrelevant operators. And the RG flow takes us out to infinity, goes in the space. This is the kind of thing that I write papers about, I suppose. And that's the conclusion of my talk. So I'll leave this up here, which is, again, going a bit broad, a nice motto for these kinds of subjects. So this nice quote by Kolmogorov. Yankov. Well, thank you.
Any questions for Vasu?
Yeah.
Can you obtain not just, well, you just talked about Wilsonian renormalization, but can you also obtain not just negative, you also interpret non-perturbative things?
Well, I mean, Wilsonian renormalization is non-perturbative.
Oh, yeah. But do you actually, people actually do computations on non-perturbative things in these?
Yeah, well, the thing is that you have to ask non-perturbative in which parameter, right? So what happens is that if you want this to just be a theory of a metric, right? That means that the stress tensor has to be the only source or the only operator on the boundary, right? What does that technically mean? Well, it means that every other operator, right, has gained an infinite anomalous dimension, which means that the theory is strongly coupled. The stress tensor is protected because of its Ward identity. So in that sense, the theory is already, non-perturbative. However, you also deal usually in theories that possess a large number of degrees of freedom, or that there is a large n limit that you can take. So the fact that we're obtaining classical equations of motion in the bulk is a reflection of the fact that we're at the large n limit. So it's perturbative in 1 over n. However, it's non-perturbative in whatever the coupling of the theory is. So in H bar, for example, of the boundary theory, it's kind of non-perturbative.
So in principle, you're investigating this prescription of going, moving in the radiuses inside the bulk as being analogous to the RG flow.
Mm-hmm.
And as you do the RG flow, some couplings, at least thinking field theory stuff, become irrelevant, right?
I should explain this better then. So what I'm saying is that if I want a regularized description of the theory here, right, I need to implement a cutoff. And the cutoff I implement that pulls me to a constant radius hypersurface in the bulk is implemented through some specific irrelevant operators. So every regularization corresponds to adding irrelevant operators. You can think of it this way. And the point is, you want the right kind of regularization for whatever your purposes are, either computational tractability, or in this case, because there's some geometrical meaning to there being you know, this regularization putting you to the surface in the bulk or whatever. And under the RG, all irrelevant operators are driven to zero. Their couplings are driven to zero. So that means that, you know, if I left to this theory's own devices, it would flow back to this one at infinity. So that's sort of what I meant.
So yeah, so the question that I had was kind of like crazy, but let's say that I wanted to, let's say that in the middle of my bulk, I have a couple of, you know, black holes going together,
yeah.
They're emitting gravitational radiation, and, you know, there's some, I guess that there's some sort of notion that the closer I am, you know, the gravitational waves are going to have decayed more or less, and the farther I go away, the details of this gravitational radiation is going to be at least different because it's going to decay, lose energy, whatever. So I was wondering if, you know, by understanding, like, first of all, what are the assumptions on, for example, asymptotically far away? Like, could you have gravitational radiation positive or
yeah.
Coming, outcoming?
So this, I should have mentioned, is an ADS space, which means it has ADS boundary conditions. So gravitational radiation hits the boundary and bounces off of it.
Oh, okay. Okay.
That's what ADS space is for you. It's a box, literally. You can go bounce off. But this is a smaller ADS space, the one which has the truncated finite boundary. The question of whether you can have flat space asymptotics remains open.
Other questions? If not, then we can thank Matthew again.